This is Franz Amazon. Welcome back to the Travel Trade Exchange podcast, Stories of Travel. This week I have a great show. I do an interview with one of my favorite authors, my favorite adventure travel authors, Eric Hansen. Eric Hansen wrote one of my favorite books, Stranger in the Forest, on foot across Borneo. Later he wrote another book, Motoring with Muhammad, Journeys to Yemen and the Red Sea. He's a great storyteller, a great author. Other books he's written include Orchid Fever, The Birdman and the Lap Dancer, and he's working on one right now about dancing, of all things. But first, I need to talk about the website, TravelTradeExchange.com, www.TravelTradeExchange.com. We've set up this website so that you can contribute your own travel stories, either in written format or in an MP3 audio format. And I'm looking forward to people that don't like to type, like me, to upload either their MP3 file or else call in on the phone-in line. And the information around the phone-in line is at the website. So please go to the website, use it as a resource, use it for entertainment, and provide some of your own information and help the website live. In addition to that, we finally got the services section up and running that allows you to post services that you're willing to trade with other people or look for commercial services in places you're going to travel. This is set up so it's all free. There's no charges. And so just help me make this a vibrant community, will you? Now on to the interview. This is Franz Amazon. I'm talking to the writer Eric Hansen. Eric Hansen has been one of my favorite writing authors, adventure writing authors over the years, and I remember reading a long time his book, Stranger in the Forest, where he walks across Borneo. He's written other books, Orchid Fever, The Birdman and the Lap Dancer, Motoring with Muhammad. A great adventure travel writer. Eric, thank you for joining me today.
Thanks. Glad to be with you, Franz.
You live in Northern California now.
Yeah, I live in the Central Valley of California, and I've had a house here for about 20 years. But from the very early 70s until the late 90s, I was pretty much nomadic, and I traveled all over the world, felt no need to have any home base. And that was when I did most of my long trips. I walked across the island of Borneo in the early 80s. I spent most of 1976 living in Nepal. I hiked probably, God, I don't know, maybe 2,000 miles, a little footpath along the Tibetan border. And it was, considering the type of upbringing I had, I was brought up in the San Francisco Bay Area, very conventional middle-class family. My mother ran a little children's theater. My father was a chemical engineer for Shell Oil. And neither one of them had traveled. But I had a grandmother who, my mother's mother, who was the great traveler in the family. She got to Kathmandu before I did. She'd been to Egypt. She and her husband went down to Mexico right after World War II, and they would rent houses in these little quiet villages, one of them being Puerto Vallarta, which is now quite different. But she learned the language, and she would bring back textiles and pottery, and it made me interested in how other people live. And my mother, she bought me books, Joshua Slocum's Sailing Around the World Alone, Kon-Tiki, and Kipling. I was brought up on that as bedtime stories. So I think I always had the travel bug, but it took actually the Vietnam War. I was drafted. I was a student at University of California, Berkeley. And I had spent my junior year studying art history in the Soviet Union. And after that summer, I traveled around Greece, northern Spain, the Riviera. And it really caught my interest, how much fun it was to travel. And the experiences that were sort of just brought to me on a platter. I couldn't have imagined them. I couldn't have dreamt them up in my wildest moments. Things just happened on the road, and I think anybody that has traveled realizes that, there is such a thing as fate and good luck and good fortune. And you have to be open to it, though. When I first left the United States in protest to the war of Vietnam, I went to live in a little village in northern Spain. And this village was so poor. Laundry was still done by hand at a community well. The house I lived in, there was salted pork in a steamer trunk in the basement. There were chickens running around in the attic to keep warm. And it just, for most of the people in the developing world, this is nothing. But for me, who was brought up in the 1950s and 60s in the United States, this is astonishing. It was like I'd gone to a different planet. So once I got started, I just couldn't stop. And being in northern Spain, you know, I got interested in North Africa, went down and spent about 3 months traveling, hitchhiking all over Morocco, came back to the Mediterranean and ended up living on an island in Greece.
Which island?
And I went there. Well, I'm not going to mention it because nobody knows about it. that's one thing, the golden rule, if you find a place and fall in love with it, don't tell anybody else because it won't stay that way very long.
I agree 100%. I found this little pension in Cappadocia, and I've gone back there four or five times, and I'll tell some of my close friends about it, but I won't put it on a podcast because I don't want it to be ruined. So go ahead.
Anyway, it's in the Kiklades Islands. It's not Eos. It's much better than that. But just recently, I went back there after 35 years. I ended up spending about, God, how long there? The entire winter, most of the spring. And I was one of three foreigners on the entire island. And I never became conversant in Greek, but I could understand quite a bit. And I had a fantastic time. I rented a house for $19.50 a month. This is a two-bedroom house. It must have been 500 years old, had a fireplace in the bedroom, and this commanding view of just this beautiful, quintessential Greek island harbor. And, you know, my friends, you know, my neighbors, they made olive oil from their own olive trees. There was no store on the island. You'd have to go to the farmer, local farmer, to get food once a week. All the wine was made on the island. And after that happened, I'd been gone from the United States about a year and a half at that point. I just thought, this is it. My life is on the road. And I thought, because I left the United States in protest of the war in Vietnam, I assumed that I would never be able to come home. Or if I did, I would end up in jail. And so my focus was no longer home, was no longer the California. It was the road. And that allowed me to live more in the moment. My point of reference was where I was. And I really learned to live day by day.
And how do you support yourself? I talked to a friend of mine who, you know, it's interesting. Back in the 1970s, I think a lot of Americans had the opportunity to travel because they decided to protest the Vietnam War. And I think there was a group of Americans that suddenly saw the world through different eyes that are aging right now, that just had to leave. They had to go somewhere. And I interviewed a friend named John, and he ended up supporting his travel habit by smuggling jewelry. He would go to Turkey and buy jewelry and then go out to the streets of Europe and sell it on the streets. And that's how he made his money. How did you support yourself?
Well, for example, when I was living on this Greek island, my expenses were practically non-existent. I had my own kitchen. Less than $20 a month for my rent. That's not even a dollar a day. And I probably lived very well, maybe on $3 a day. So that doesn't take a lot of money. I think I left the United States with $800, but airfares, moving around, that's what's expensive. Actually living in a place in a developing country, expenses are very small. What else did I do? I I would do stuff. I've always been pretty handy, plumbing, carpentry, all of that. And so when I was on the Greek islands, I would occasionally so I would say, "Do you want to paint my house, or do you want to do this or that?" And I go, "Yeah," and I would trade them for something. So I never did anything illegal. There was when I was living in Kathmandu, this guy told me, he said, "Hey, I've got a Volkswagen van. And do you have any idea how much money you can make smuggling Chinese erasers to India?" And I thought he was joking. I go, "What do you mean a lot of money?" And he goes, "Well, you can drive up to," it was just this harebrained scheme. So we drive his VW van up to the Tibetan border. And he's got a contact there. And I don't know how many, I don't know, 500 pounds of erasers. I mean, we filled up the back of his van, drove down to northern India, bribed the border guard, because he knew what the game was. Plenty of people were doing this. And in North India, to a wholesaler, sold these erasers. And the profit of that we split was enough for me to travel for 2 years. And it wasn't a lot of money. It might have been $1,000 or something. I used to go to Burma every couple of years. The first time I was there, I noticed the women, they have really short eyelashes. I mean, they're so beautiful. But I mentioned to this Burmese guy who I was staying in this little guest house, he said, "Oh, if you ever come back, bring fake eyelashes with you. You'll make a fortune." I'm going, "Are you kidding?" He said, "Oh, they're impossible to find here." The next time I came, I brought, I don't know, 1,000 sets of false eyelashes that I got in Thailand. They cost nothing there. So little things like that I would do. And the interesting thing about traveling in the early 70s and into the 80s was there were no guidebooks. This was pre-Lonely Planet. I met Tony and Maureen Wheeler in Singapore when they were working on their first guidebook to Southeast Asia, which led to this huge publishing concern that they've got now. But people would exchange information. And if you met somebody coming from the direction in which you were going, you'd say, "Okay, what should I bring with me? Where are the good guest houses to stay? Where can you change money on the black market?" All this stuff, which is common exchange of information. Well, the genius of the Wheelers was to actually take all this information and to publish it, and at the end to say, "Things change, and if anybody would like to make editorial comments and help us update our book, we'd be happy to, put your name at the back of the book and, type that you need a magnifying glass to look at." But it was that's the way that's that that was sort of the model for guidebooks, and it's been hugely successful. But for me, it's sort of taken a lot of the adventure out of travel, because now you can get a guidebook and it will tell you everything you need to know about the country. So by the time you get there, that sort of element of serendipity, mystery has been taken away from you. And what you find now, or what I found, is you have these sort of expat ghettos in places like Bangkok and Bali. When I first went to Bali, Kuta Beach, which is just a nightmare place now, there was no restaurant. There was a little corner food stall that people ate at. It was a fishing village, and people would let you stay in their houses. And you look at it now, it's just this honky-tonk sort of drug, techno music infested ghetto, really, filled with foreigners and, Indonesians who are, feeding off this business. So on the one hand, travel books have made it easier to travel, but it's in a way, a very profound way, it's actually changed the destinations from what they were. When I remember the first time I went to Afghanistan, and this was 1972, we crossed the border from Iran in the middle of the night, and we had to spend the night at the border. And there must have been kind of a busload of us, Afghanis, Europeans, Americans. And the border guard, on our way in, said, you know, see, passports, blah, 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 very perfunctory. And then he said, are you carrying any drugs? And everybody, of course, said no. So anyway, after, you know, everybody sort of settled in for the evening, ready to camp out at the border, waiting for the clearance to get through to Herat the next morning, the same border guard in his Afghan clothes, no longer in his military uniform, comes up and said, oh, I asked everybody if they've had any drugs, and if nobody does, but I have some hashish here if anybody'd like to smoke it. And everybody cracked up. We thought, well, are you trying to bust us? And he goes, no, it's, you know, it's normal. So we sat around with the border guard, smoked hash, and I'm thinking, oh my God, Afghanistan, what a place. So we get to Herat, and about six of us go out to dinner, I remember. And sitting up on, there was a little vestibule when you come in, and the door, sort of like, there was like a mud room, two doors to get into the restaurant. And on top of that was a little platform, like a very small mezzanine, with a boy operating an old gramophone that he had to crank by hand, and he was playing these old records. I mean, these records were just ancient. We sat down, we all had dinner, and at the end, we asked for the bill. And the six people, complete dinner, several courses, kebabs, I mean, just delicious Afghani food. It was $1.37. That was for all six of us. And I just thought, oh my God, I have enough money. I could live here for 10 years. And so, and this is just a long-winded answer to your question about how do I afford to travel. Well, when you travel close to the ground, take public transport, and you don't have any time limitations, it's fairly reasonable to travel. I remember coming home about 10 years later, and I had worked on a fishing boat in Australia, and I'd worked here and there. I probably had saved $15,000 or $20,000. I come home for a Christmas visit to the Bay Area, and friends of mine would say, how can you afford to travel? And I said, how can you afford to stay home? You probably spend more on traffic tickets in a month than I spend, you know, traveling around India. And I'd always traveled light. And speaking of India, I would go to a fabric, well, and I needed new clothes, you know, new shirt, you know, I saw a nice, you know, bolt of linen or, you know, perfect khaki drill fabric for shorts or pants or whatever. I would go to a tailor and say, okay, how many yards do I need? They'd usually send an assistant to me to the fabric market. I'd select what I wanted. They'd cut it. We'd march back to the tailor. 2 days later, I would have like a tailor-made shirt or shoulder bag or whatever I needed for like $1 or $2. And so here I am eating in restaurants every day, tailor-made clothes, you know, learning the language of a culture and immersing myself in a place that only the very most wealthy segment of our society can actually live like that. In the United States. And so this became a way of life for nearly 20 years. My most difficult transition in terms of travel was coming back to the United States and trying to settle down within my own culture. I remember the first 6 months, this is after I got shipwrecked in Yemen, and came home, and I had a little bit of money saved up, but that money doesn't go very far in the United States. And this was, I came back to San Francisco, and within a month, the Jonestown massacre had happened, and then Mayor Moscone and Harvey Milk were assassinated, And I just looked at what I remembered as being my own country, and I've never felt like I was in such a foreign place. Nothing made sense to me. The first 6 months I was back, I hardly socialized at all. Things that people did just made no sense to me at all. The insane consumer culture. I was used to having all of my worldly possessions in a day pack, sort of the size that kids take to school with their books, like a book bag. That was it. You know, I'd have a notebook, I'd have two changes of clothes, I'd have a sarong, I'd have a razor, you know, bar of soap. I mean, how much do you really need? And I found that people in the United States live very lonely, insular lives, by and large. I'm working on give you an example. In the town that I live in, you know, I know my neighbors a little bit. And I'm working on a book about salsa dancing now. And friends of mine wanted to get married in my yard. And so I said, well, we have to have a dance floor. So the groom and I, we spent a week and we built a 1,000-square-foot dance floor in my backyard. And I alerted the neighbors that, you know, there was going to be a party. They were all welcome. We tried to keep the noise down. And the resentment and, you know, the number of times the police were called, and it was mainly Hispanic people that came, but it was that there was something out of the ordinary that was going on. And the fifth time, there's no exaggeration, the fifth time the police came, I just said, officer, we're just having a wedding party here. The children are playing with piñatas. We're doing this. We're doing that. It's not, you can barely hear the music. It was just the idea of other people having fun really pissed off the neighborhood. So finally, the party came to an end. But I remember going out on the street, and the last people were leaving, and it was all very orderly. There was nothing going on. But some of the phone calls were, oh, there's gang activity in my house, and the cops come in, and I'm 62 years old, I'm a white guy, and I go, gang activity? I don't think so. So the reason I bring that up is that one of my Mexican friends said, gosh, you know, if this was Mexico City, all the neighbors would be here. They'd bring a plate of food. They would dance. This is a fiesta. This is more than, you know, a party. And I thought, God, that speaks volumes about our culture here. People work and work and work and save all this money. They don't have a clue how to have a good time. And you don't need a lot of money to have a good time. You know, being with friends, good conversation, dancing, some music. I mean, what else is there in life?
You know, and you mentioned that, and I just know when I travel through, and I've spent a lot of time in Turkey, about a year of my life in Turkey over the last 10 years, and I'll drive through these towns, I'll get off the by roads and just go into these small towns, but men are sitting out on the, you know, you see men sitting with each other in coffee shops talking all afternoon, older men. And when I come back to America, you don't see that. You don't see places for older people just to go and spend time with each other. And it is a very lonely culture that we've developed here. It's very lonely.
I mean, so many people I know just live by themselves. And granted, I do too, but I turned my living room into a dance studio about 5 years ago. and people come by. I've got two local teachers who teach private lessons here. I have every Thursday, one of my dance partners comes by. We dance. People just drop by. Last night, some people came by, started off, you know, bottle of wine. Then I went to a dance lesson. I came back. We had dinner. And I thought, this is how it works in the rest of the world. And I think of the number of times that I was traveling, and it could be, you know, a rickshaw driver, a cab driver, somebody at a hotel desk, a dried fruit, you know, vendor in Calcutta would befriend me. They'd take me home and have dinner with me, you know, meet the family, have dinner, you know, entertain me. And I always think, how many Americans have ever done that to a foreigner? I mean, by and large, people are so frightened of strangers. And for good reason in our culture. But there is a level of hospitality throughout the world that is just astonishing. I've spent a lot of time in Yemen since 1978, which was when I got shipwrecked there. And I've had some hair-raising experiences there, but I'll tell you, I feel much safer in Yemen. And I've traveled the most remote corners of Yemen. I feel much safer there than I do here. Somebody's going to steal your car or rob you, they're not going to hurt you physically. They want the goods. But they know from, you know, watching, you know, the news that in the United States, a stranger will kill another stranger for $10 or a wristwatch. And they go, oh, that's, we would never do that. But yet Yemenis have this, reputation as being very violent and lawless and tribal, and it's sort of a contradiction in terms, because there's such a thing as tribal law, and this isn't just blood feuds, but it's, you know, with any society, there are problems, there are things that happen. And the way they sort out those problems are profoundly different than how we do it. And in my book, Muttering with Muhammad, I touch on a lot of these things, you know. Public execution. I watched a public execution in Yemen, and I was totally horrified. And then I interviewed people, and I discovered that, well, this man who was executed in a fit of anger had killed a young husband who had a wife, two little kids. It was a stupid argument. He'd lost his temper. And so he's thrown in jail, and no self-respecting Yemeni would go the O.J. Simpson route. If you're going to commit a crime, you're going to take responsibility for it. That's just a given. You don't have the lying and the deception that you have in our culture. I mean, here, basically, what you can get away with is okay, or what you can pay your way out of is okay. So anyway, to make a long story short, in my book, Motoring with Muhammad, I described this execution. And the family, the aggrieved family, had three options. They could pardon him, which would give them incredible status within their community. They could accept money, or they could ask for his death. And they felt that they negotiated for a year. All parties, you know, both families discussed it. And the family finally decided that, no, we want his death. He killed our son, our, you know, our husband, our brother, and he needs to die. And so this was all discussed. It was agreed upon. The other options were weighed. And the deal is that he was not just going to be taken off somewhere. Both families had to watch the execution. And so the man was shot, and his body was taken away, prepared, and everything. And this was a public statement that okay, justice has been done. There's going to be no more payback here. This is how we settle things within our tribal society. And I'm thinking, that makes incredibly good sense, because this is decided by the families involved, not by some court, not by some, you know, high-paid lawyer, and not in a remote place. It's settled within the community. And I'm thinking, this is justice. And so whenever I read about the lawless tribal lands of Yemen, I just have to laugh. And I go, only somebody who knows nothing about Islamic culture, and especially Yemeni culture, could say something like that.
You know, I was at a family party this summer, and one of my aunts mentioned that her granddaughter was working in Turkey, and that she prayed every night for her safety because it's so dangerous over there. And I said, what? She said, oh, it's so dangerous. I said, have you been to Turkey? She said, no, but I read. I just know what it's like in those cultures. And I said, you have no clue. I've never felt more safe in a country than I have wandering around Turkey. I've had so many random acts of kindness given to me by total strangers that that we have a very warped sense of what these countries are like. And you mentioned in your book, Motoring with Muhammad, and I did a podcast on random acts of kindness that I've received, and my partner talked about some of his. But you had an amazing random act of kindness that you describe in your book, Motoring with Muhammad, from when you were trying to get out of the country from the airline. Talk about
Oh,
that.
right. I went to, okay, I was, for those who have not yet read Motoring with Muhammad, I get shipwrecked in the Red Sea, and I'm there for 10 days. I finally get rescued by a boatload of Ethiopian goat smugglers who are going from Ethiopia to Yemen. And I'm with a French couple and an American couple. We arrive in Yemen. We are, arrested as suspected spies, spend 10 days in jail, and eventually end up in Sana'a, the capital city of Yemen. I have no money. I've got, I think, about $125 to my name, or at least in my pocket. I had more money in a bank account in the United States, but there was no time to actually access that money. So I needed to get back to the United States, and I thought, well, I wonder if an airline would forward me a ticket and I could pay them back later. I didn't really have any other options. I went to the U.S. Embassy. They directed me into the most expensive hotel in town and wished me the best of luck. Well, I end up going to different airlines, and I went to, it was called North Yemen Airlines in those days. Now it's called Yemenia, and it's a very modern airline. And I walk in, and I sit down with the general manager of Yemenia and explain my situation. And I only get about 2 minutes into the explanation. And he goes, "What can I do to help you?" And I go, "Well, I need to fly back to the United States." He goes, "Well, we don't have an international flight to the United States. But this is what I can do. I can get you to Athens, and from there you'll be on your own." I said, "Fine, how much is the ticket?" And he goes, "Nothing." I go, "What do you mean?" He goes, "The airline can afford it, and in my culture, we help people in need." And I thought he was kidding. I just thought, "You're just going to give me a ticket?" And he just said, "Come back tomorrow and pick up your ticket." So I came back, and not only did he have a ticket for me, he had a ticket for everybody, five tickets to Athens. And I said, "Well, how can I repay you?" And he goes, "You don't have to repay me or the airline, but the next time you see a human being in need, I want you to pass on this favor." And so, with ticket in hand, I walk out of the office and I'm thinking, what an incredible life lesson. The people that do you the biggest favors in life, you never have an opportunity to repay them, or seldom do you, but you can pass on that goodwill. And that's probably one of the most important lessons that I've learned from traveling.
Do you remember when you passed on that act of kindness to somebody else? Did you rem did you do you identify a specific act you ever made that you think of? Okay, I'm paying this back because of you did this for me. Did you? I'm sure you've done a lot
Well,
of things over the years, but I'm kind of curious about that.
the thing is that so you don't just do it once. You get in the habit of doing it because, and I retell this story. I've done, God, I mean, the most recent thing, I had two friends that had a wedding here that I described. And this couple, they're young, they don't have much money, and I thought, I can be the patron of their wedding. I'm going to put this wedding on for them. And so we had, it was 200 people here, sit down dinner. There must have been 300 people that came to dance. Everybody in my area, we all know each other, sort of a subculture of dancers. We had a, and, hired a local DJ, and who actually did it for free because he knew everybody. It's like family. And so I've repaid this favor, not once. The idea is you don't just do it once. You get in the habit of doing it. And occasionally I will pass on that story. And I'm thinking, there is a ripple effect here. This all started in 1978. And the ripple effect of goodwill is a good thing to start and to keep going. I worked in in my most recent book, which is a collection of stories from 30 years of travel, I describe working in Mother Teresa's Home for the Dying Destitute in Calcutta. Well, in 1978, nobody knew who Mother Teresa was, and neither did I. And a French girlfriend was working in the women's clinic, and she said, "Why don't you come in one day and just see what it's like?" And I ended up working there for 4 months, and I expected to be totally horrified. You know, emaciated street people, some of who had been chewed on by dogs and pecked at by birds. People were messed up, and they were all dying. Anybody that went into the home for the dying destitute, nobody hit the street again. And while I was working there, I just thought, all the favors that the people have done for me over the years, all the generosity, this is an opportunity to pay some of that back. And I think that everybody, whatever your station is in life, that it can't just be take, 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 take. You have to give back from time to time. And you don't have to travel to do that. You can do it on a daily basis. Just being kind to people, to give somebody a smile, make them feel good about themselves. You can do this with strangers. But I tend to try to take care of friends and family. And I think it's part of who I am, but certainly thinking back to in my time of need, not just when I got shipwrecked in Yemen and I needed a ticket, I can just think there must be hundreds of examples of people just appearing out of nowhere and providing whatever needed to be provided.
You, in your book, The Birdman and the Lap Dancer, you describe your time on Thursday Island when you were working, when you just survived a cyclone, and you ended up going into this crazy, crazy town and staying at the Grand Hotel. It's a great story, and I loved it. But what I also liked is when you talk about going back later. Have you gone back to many of the places you visited in the 70s and 80s and seen how they've changed, and how does that affect you?
Well, it depends on the place. There are certain places in the world where the first time I went there, they seem so familiar that I may not have spoken the language at all, never even seen a photograph of the place, knew nothing about it, but yet it's given me a sense of going home. And these are just, you know, offbeat places. Calcutta. All I knew about Calcutta was the black hole of Calcutta. And, you know, lepers and people living on the streets and the extreme poverty. Well, the first time I went to Calcutta, I totally fell in love with it. And there was something about the place. Going to Sydney, Australia, I had similar experience. Paris, everybody falls in love with Paris, but I've been going back to Paris for like 35 years, and I know the streets of Paris probably better than I know the streets of San Francisco. I don't even have to look at the street signs. I know pretty much where everything is. And I'm a great walker. I love exploring cities on foot. And there are some places, in answer to your question, that I don't want to go back to because I'm so convinced that they've just been totally ruined. Kabul, for one, Afghanistan. It would break my heart to go back there to see the destruction. I went back to Bali, back to Kuta Beach after 20 years, and I didn't recognize it. You know, the palm trees must have been the same, but it was just so thoroughly ruined that I just sort of turned around and, you know, went up to the mountains and found a nice little village that, you know, Balinese culture still predominated. And there wasn't this sort of honky-tonk aspect to it. But I find myself going back to the same places. Kuching, the capital of Sarawak in East Malaysia. It's like my second hometown. I went there. I was married for 10 years, and during that time, I took my wife to Kuching and showed her the rainforest and went up river and did all these interesting things that I originally discovered in the early 80s when I spent 7 months living with nomadic hunters and gatherers in the rainforest. But we're in Kuching, which is sort of a old British colonial riverside town. We're walking down the main street, and people in Malay are greeting me and saying hi to me, and I'm not even noticing anything's out of the ordinary. And my wife finally turns to me. She goes, "What are those people saying?" I said, "They're just saying hi, welcome back." She goes, "Do you know all those people?" I go, "Yeah." She goes, "We live in San Francisco. This never happens. Not nearly as many people know you." And I go, "Well, I'm a white guy, stand out. I speak Malay, and I made a lot of friends here over the last 20 years. And so Kuching is a place I like going back to. Portland, Oregon. Melbourne, Australia. Just, you know, some places just call to me. And occasionally I'll go to a new place. But I sort of have my routine. Favorite places to go. Whenever I fly to the Middle East, I have to stop off for a night somewhere in Europe. And, you know, my choices are Frankfurt, London, or Paris. It's a no-brainer. I'm going to go to Paris. I've got friends there, you know, and on the way back, you know, I have to stop off also. So there's no, I mean, people talk about, oh, where's your next big trip? And I don't so much think of, you know, racking up new destinations. I traveled from the late 60s, from when I first went to Europe. I went to the Soviet Union to study for a summer. I traveled pretty much nonstop until the late 90s. So that's almost 30 years. And, you know, there are places I'd like to go to. I'm going to go to Cuba in January as part of a literary travel group. But mainly that's to check out the local dancing and, you know, meet musicians and do that. But I don't have this, and I don't think I ever had this crazy desire to rack up the countries and the places. I met some people probably about a year ago, and they're both quite wealthy, and they said, "Oh, we've been to 37 countries. How many have you been to?" And I go, "I never even thought to count. I really, that's not what it's all about. I have no idea. I've probably traveled around the world 10 times. I don't know, I've been to a zillion places." But it's not so much how many places, it's not so much where you go, it's what you do when you get there. And if you sit in a hotel and watch CNN or go out to a, you know, Western-style restaurant, have you really gone anywhere? There was, in the first time I went to Bali, I met a man who was on a plumbers convention from Northern Australia. And obviously this is all about, you know, getting drunk and, you know, blowing off some steam. But he was actually trying to learn some Indonesian. And he was just, you could tell, he was just thrilled to be in a foreign country. He'd never traveled out of Australia. This guy fixed plumbing for a living. You know, probably not much education, but it opened his eyes. And he just couldn't get enough of the Balinese culture, the music, the dancing. And while all his friends were off getting obliterated at the local bars, he was, you know, hiring local drivers to take around the island. I'm thinking, that's fantastic. That's travel. And 2 days later, I met this young Frenchman. He'd been to Bali 30 times. And you know what? He didn't speak Indonesian. He didn't speak Balinese. You know, he looked cool. He wore a sarong, and he hung out at the beach, got stoned, you know, hit up on, you know, the tourist women. I'm thinking, okay, who's the great traveler here? The guy in the plumbers convention or the cool French guy with the curly hair? I'm thinking, the French guy? He hasn't left France. The only thing that makes him unusual here is that he actually hasn't arrived. He lives in this sort of nether region that's neither France nor Bali. And to me, that's not traveling.
Well, that was the end of part one of this interview. This interview ended up oh, lasting about 90 minutes, 95 minutes. And I'm going to continue this interview on the next podcast. We'll catch the rest of it. And he's got some great stories to tell that you've yet to listen to. So be sure you tune in when I post the next podcast episode. And again, please go to our website, www.traveltradeexchange.com. This is Franz Amundsen. Thanks for listening. Please tell your friends about us.